from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A very unusual public fight has broken out between the Bush administration and respected members of the U.S. scientific community over whether the White House is letting ideology and industrial interests distort American science. 20 Nobel laureates are among those who signed a report accusing the administration of, quote, the manipulation, suppression, and misrepresentation, end quote, of science. The Bush administration is firing back with a point-by-point rebuttal and a dismissal of the charges as preposterous. Tonight on Point, charges of an attack on science and the Bush defense. David Malakoff has been covering the controversy for Science magazine. He joins me now from Alexandria, Virginia. David, tell us about the original report from the Union of Concerned Scientists and why it generated so much attention.
Yeah, well, I think among those of us who cover science policy, there was a little bit of a surprise that the report caused such a stir. It covered about 20 instances in which the UCS said the administration had either suppressed or distorted or prevented scientific findings from coming to light to support their policies. Almost all of those instances had received a fair amount of coverage in my journal, the New York Times, other major media outlets. And so when the report first came out in February, it was essentially a putting together of all of these charges. And I think some of us who cover this area were a bit surprised that John Marburger, the White House science advisor,
yes,
came out very quickly with some very strong statements, essentially dismissing all of the charges. And I think that that combined with the prominence of some of the signers of the statement really ignited the issue.
Give us a sense of the kind of criticisms that were collected in this report by the Union of Concerned Scientists, if you would.
Well, they fall into a couple of categories. One general category is that the administration has essentially applied a political litmus test to people, to scientists that it appoints to many, many scientific advisory boards. The government has some 500 or 600 of these advisory bodies, mm-hmm, that advise the government on a variety of issues. And the charge was that advisory bodies that deal with particularly controversial issues, the appointees were being sifted either for their support of the president. They were being scientists reported that they were being asked if they supported the president, whether they had voted for Bush,
mm-hmm,
or they were being sifted to appoint people who supported a particular position, which might have been backed by industry, and things like that. And there were a number of these cases, a half dozen or more, maybe a dozen.
And this is consequential because these advisory boards make consequential recommendations?
I think that's open to debate. Some of them do, some of them don't. But there's no question that they are looked at to be, you know, somewhat independent, objective arbiters and analyzers of some of these issues.
And on this first category of complaint, is it clear whether or not this is the case? Is it clear that the deck has been, I don't know what to say, stacked with people who politically or ideologically or in terms of business interests are aligned toward some agenda or not?
Well, I think first it's important to say that every administration has the right to appoint whoever it pleases to these bodies. These are presidential appointees.
Right.
And just like a cabinet position, a president can appoint whoever they choose. Now, in my own reporting has suggested that, and reporting done by my colleagues at Science, has suggested that, yes, either the ideological tilt or the previous position that some of these scientists had held on a particular issue probably did play a role in some of these appointments. However, these situations are often quite murky, and it's often hard to get to the bottom of them.
And then there's another category of complaint you were citing?
Yeah, there are several other categories.
Okay.
There's a broad category that the administration has either removed, distorted, or watered down reports that the government puts out on a variety of issues. So one of the much-discussed instances is where a discussion of the climate change issue was removed from an EPA report. As you'll hear later from your guest, the administration points out that much of that material appeared in a later report that they issued on the science of climate change, and that this really wasn't an issue, an instance of muzzling or preventing the public from getting this information, but they just felt that the second report did a better job of discussing it.
Okay.
And in fact, the science advisor, Dr. Marburger, admits that it was a very testy battle within the administration over this language between the EPA and the White House and some other agencies, and that he, in fact, generally supported the idea that the language should stay in the EPA report, but it wasn't his agency's report, and it wasn't his decision, and the language ultimately did come out.
As a journalist looking on as a third party, how does it look to you? I suppose you could have left it in both places.
You could have. The administration, when it came out, and it made no secret of the fact that it was not particularly impressed by the arguments of the previous administration on climate change. It made a very early decision not to support the Kyoto Protocol, the international pact to try to do to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And it has been quite critical of some of the science underlining the climate change debate. So I don't think this was a big surprise, but it upset many scientists who had worked on the issue.
And other significant categories of complaint we should be aware of to understand this flap?
Those are two of the major ones. There are also a number of instances in which critics are very upset that the administration appears to have muzzled or silenced government scientists who work for the government, who wanted to report on scientific findings or present their views on a particular issue, and because of opposition from either ideological foes or from industry sources, were not allowed to do that. There's one particularly noted case in which a USDA researcher discovered in the course of other work that hog farms, commercial hog farms, can produce antibiotic-resistant bacteria that can drift into the air and away from these farms. He was permitted to talk about that work in several instances, but the UCS claimed on at least 11 other occasions he was not permitted to talk about that work.
David Malakoff, we're going to hear from some folks involved in this back and forth tonight, but from your view there at Science, how does it look? You said much of this was not a surprise. Is there a consensus one way or another about whether or not a new kind of atmosphere around science has been created under the Bush administration, an inhospitable atmosphere, or not?
I think it's not clear, and it varies from industry from issue to issue. The administration has taken a number of positions which are very unpopular with scientists. Nobody denies that. But as I say, in many of these instances, and as Dr. Marburger often points out, when it comes to policy decisions, science does not have the last word often. There are economic concerns, there are ideological concerns, there are many things that factor into these decisions. And so it's a little unclear. Having said that, I will say that the administration has been unusually ham-handed in some of these decisions. They are continually publicly embarrassed by decisions that either are come out in a way which they had not intended or the timing of them. I mean, for instance, almost immediately after the administration issued its denials of the UCS report, they removed two very critical members from a bioethics panel, literally days after the first report came out. And so it made the administration look rather poorly.
David Malakoff, thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
David Malakoff is a staff writer for Science magazine. He spoke with me from Alexandria, Virginia. We're talking tonight about a report by a group of concerned scientists accusing the Bush administration of manipulating, suppressing, and misrepresenting science to drive a political agenda. The administration has published a point-by-point rebuttal of that report. Could ideology or business interest be a real threat to mighty American science? Is science vulnerable to politics, to suppression? Is American culture immune to an ideological capsizing of science or not? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Ithaca, New York, is the chairman of the Union of Concerned Scientists, Kurt Gottfried. He's an emeritus professor of physics at Cornell University. Good evening and welcome, Dr. Kurt Gottfried.
Hello, how are you?
Very well. Thanks very much for joining us. We've heard a little bit of the detail that was in the report from Union of Concerned Scientists that came out in February, but I wish you'd take us to a very kind of high level for a moment, Kurt Gottfried. What's the charge here? What's the concern? What's the most fundamental concern that your group was trying to express?
Our concern is that the administration is getting scientific advice that is distorted. I want to point out that we are not claiming that the administration is attacking science. That's not the issue. Several times this has been stated, and that's not correct. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, I've not heard Dr. Marburger say what's just been cited by David Malakoff, but we agree that science cannot be the only deciding factor in policy decisions. Of course, there are many other factors that come in, and it's rather rare that science is the only factor. We're not contending that it should be. in many cases, the decision maker, political decision maker, leader has to take other factors into account, economic factors, even just plain political factors. Mm-hmm. What we are contending, and we believe we've made this case very strongly, mm-hmm. is that the administration is not getting undistorted scientific input before it makes its decisions. We would not be making this case, and we've never made this case for previous administrations, Republican or Democratic, that there has been a pervasive distortion of the scientific input into decisions. We've often made, we wouldn't be able to get all these people to agree if it was a policy, that we were contesting.
Mm-hmm, right.
It's the process by which science enters into policy-making decisions that we're concerned about.
If I may just say,
we have, amongst our signers, we have people who've worked as appointees of Republican presidents, as advisors to Republican presidents, going back to Eisenhower. And we, in fact, would hold up and have explained that, for example, the Eisenhower administration and the Nixon and Ford administrations mm-hmm. had high-quality science input. They also made decisions that we may not have liked, but we did never said that they were based on distortion of the scientific input into their decisions.
If that's the core complaint, then what, in your view, is the reason that the administration is not getting, in your view, undistorted scientific input before making decisions?
Our contention is that it's arranged not to get the kind of objective science that should be putting into its decision-making before it makes its decisions. We realized, of course, everybody knew that the president was elected on a platform of not opposing the Kyoto process and of a platform where he had made it clear that he was opposed to mandatory restrictions on CO on carbon dioxide mm-hmm. and other global warming gases. So that's not a surprise. The thing that we are concerned about is that there is often a misrepresentation of the scientific basis on which climate science. An exaggeration of the uncertainties. There are, of course, uncertainties in climate science. It's a difficult, complicated problem. But there is a distortion, an exaggeration of the uncertainties in order to justify not taking any action.
So you're saying
if the president came out and said, look, we think it's economically not possible to enact restrictions on climate change, on greenhouse gas mm-hmm. emissions, and gave and saw to it that the science was objectively reported, you wouldn't hear this from us. We might, some of us might be, especially the climate scientists, I'm not one of them, would be out there saying that that's a poor policy decisions, but they wouldn't be saying it was based on distortion of the science.
So you're saying they're not getting undistorted science. You're going on to say they don't want undistorted science. We've just got a minute before the break. What are the interests?
In certain areas.
What are the interests driving that distortion in your view?
Well, it's because there's a belief, which is not unreasonable, I think quite sensible, that if you can portray the science as being supportive of your decision, it makes it easier to sell that decision.
So in other words, using science to push an unscientific or unscientifically informed agenda, maybe. Is that what you're saying?
Well, or an agenda that does not put the scientific consideration as the top priority, which has been true of many administrations and often has to be the case because you just may not be able to afford the scientifically best advice, or it may be a trade-off that you don't want to take. So it's really the process by which the administration is getting science and the way it represents science that concerns us.
You're saying at
least
the
administration is not attacking this when you...
Mm-hmm. Saying not an attack but a distortion?
It is not an attack on science by the administration, as some I think you said. I would disagree with that. The administration is not attacking science.
But you're not getting that undistorted science flowing through, you're saying. Kurt Gottfried, chairman of the Union of Concerned Scientists, please stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about charges of distortion of science by the Bush administration. You can join the conversation. Could ideology or business interests be a real threat to Mighty American Science. We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about charges of distortion of science by the Bush administration, charges of the manipulation, suppression, and misrepresentation of scientific reporting refuted by the Bush administration. The Bush defenders say, no, there is not. And they've come back with a point-by-point refutation of a report by the Union of Concerned Scientists. You can join our conversation tonight. What do you think? Is science vulnerable to politics, too vulnerable to politics? Is it vulnerable to suppression? If 20 Nobel laureates say there's suppression and the Bush administration says there's not, who do you believe? And is American culture immune to an ideological capsizing of science or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I've been joined tonight from Ithaca, New York, by Kurt Gottfried. He's Emeritus Professor of Physics at Cornell University and Chairman of the Union of Concerned Scientists. We're joined now from Washington by Bob Walker. He's former Chairman of the House Science Committee. He served 20 years in the House of Representatives for Pennsylvania's 16th District. He was appointed to the G.W. Bush, by George W. Bush, to chair the Presidential Commission on the Future of the U.S. Aerospace Industries. He is Chairman of Wexler and Walker, a Washington lobbying firm. Good evening and welcome, Bob Walker.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Thanks very much for joining us. Bob Walker, you know the debate. You know the charges that the Union of Concerned Scientists, put out. And, of course, you've read the rebuttal of those from Dr. Marburger. How do you look at this whole flap and what's going on here, Bob Walker?
Well, I think it's a case where you have people who have a political agenda who are seeking to advance that political agenda by attacking the Bush administration and claiming to do it on a scientific basis. The fact is this administration has been extremely supportive of science. There's about a 44% growth in federal R&D funding that's contained in the president's FY 2005 budget over that which was being spent in 2001. It's been a great priority of this administration to back R&D, and in fact, the total discretionary outlays for science are at the highest level in 37 years. So I think that what you have is a group that simply doesn't agree politically with the administration. The Union of Concerned Scientists has a long history of taking these kinds of stands. They, back in 1992, issued a similar warning, coming out with a bunch of Nobel laureates who they said backed the position that was a collection of reasonably left-wing concepts that they passed off as being science. Their most recent report, it seems to me, is at best incomplete, and in my view, is not well documented, and in the end, is a distortion in itself.
Kurt Gottfried, how about it? There's the counter view that the Union of Concerned Scientists report is driven by a left wing political agenda. That the Bush administration has been extremely supportive of science.
We are not contending that the administration has not been supportive of science. The word funding has never appeared in any of our statements or reports.
Mm-hmm.
That is not the issue. And to raise that issue is simply to divert attention from what we are contending. And to say that we are just a partisan political group is also that is not really rebutting our charges. This the Union of Concerned Scientists has been very critical of quite a few actions by the Clinton administration. Mm. I also would like to emphasize that the 62 people who signed this statement, that's not a UCS statement. That is their statement that it was drawn up and by about 15 people, including five Nobel laureates, who then sent it over their own signature to about 75 people, I would guess, or 80, of which 60 people signed on. Most of these people have never had any connection with the Union of Concerned Scientists. They don't contribute to the Union of Concerned Scientists. They're not in any sense members of the Union of Concerned Scientists. As I said previously, quite a few of them have served as appointees of the Nixon and Ford administration. Some have been science advisors to Presidents Eisenhower, to President Nixon, to President Ford. One person was an advisor to both, served in the Nixon and served as an advisor to the Reagan administration. We have never, ever, would never dream of raising this kind of a charge against the first Bush administration, which just did not engage
well,
in this kind of
practices. That's the reason why they issued the last report then in November of 1992, just when George Bush was running for re-election.
What is that report? I'm sorry, I guess I don't remember what it is.
World Scientist Warning to Humanity.
Was that a
well, that was not, that's not a, that's not addressed against the administration at all. That was a worldwide appeal to warn that there are many environmental global effects. It was, that's not a political,
well,
that's distributed across the world and is not a political document.
Well, it was certainly filled with a lot of political issues such as family planning, sexual equality.
These are political issues, but
language. And several things, but it just happened to come out in the middle of a major political race.
Bob Walker, let me ask you, if I may, what role do you see as appropriate for politics in the interaction with science? Different administrations are going to come in with different priorities.
Sure.
Is it appropriate for an administration to come in and say, you know what, we have high priorities, including whatever they might be. We want to look again at controls on, smokestack emissions. We want to look at abstinence in terms of sex education. And we want to imprint these on our science boards. Is that an appropriate political imprint or something else?
Well, look, I mean, politicians are going to practice politics. And the fact is that many, many scientists receive their money from the federal government, and they practice politics in order to see to it that the funding that they're looking to get flows a certain way. That's certainly appropriate. I mean, I used to face it all the time as chairman of the science committee, of various scientific interests coming in, presenting their case so that they would hope that policies would be designed in a way that would favor funding for their particular programs. That's a perfectly appropriate dialogue. What's a problem is when scientists claim to be making scientific judgments that are really political judgments. I mean, this most recent document from the Union of Concerned Scientists, I recognized it well. It's the kind of document that we would put together in the political world to go out and raise money with it. It's a series of scare statements, of half-truths, and it is the kinds of things that's practiced all the time in politics, but it has nothing to do with science.
Bob Walker, let me ask you, just so everybody has their cards on the table, in your current role in Washington as a lobbyist there, do you have clients whose interests are related to this debate? Can you share with us who they might be, what industries?
Sure. We have a number of clients that that work in the areas of aerospace and technology and a number of areas like that, and they seek to influence the process. We used to represent a collection of colleges and universities. We no longer do, but some years ago we represented them, and their belief was that basic research should be promoted in federal funding. I happen to agree with that position. That's a great position to have, but they were willing to go full front in lobbying. That's what the process is all about.
And Kurt Gottfried, let me put it to you then. I came into this understanding that the Union of Concerned Scientists is saying that there was a political agenda being kind of pushed back against objective scientific reporting. Bob Walker's posing it the other way. He's saying, no, it's you guys, Union, who are bringing a political agenda to this. So what's going on?
Well, Mr. Walker has raised, again, this funding issue. May I ask, where does he think what we're doing will improve the funding situation for science? If anything, what we're doing may well endanger the funding for science. I just don't understand why funding for science would be improved by what we're saying. We're claiming that democratic government based on objective science is what's being threatened. Science itself directly, as I've said now twice,
yes,
is not being threatened. The Bush administration, we're not complaining about science support by the Bush administration. We're not complaining about Dr. Marburger's efforts on behalf of science funding. In fact, we have a lot of respect for Dr. Marburger. He's a colleague of ours and a person of high integrity, and we do not question that he's been effective in science funding. This is a red herring to bring in the funding situation.
It's not a red herring in that a part of what they do in their report is attack individuals. I mean, part of their report is aimed at attacking particular people, people who serve on scientific panels. They even attack a member of Mr. Marburger's staff, who I happen to be very familiar with because he worked for me when I was the chairman of the science committee, one of the most highly qualified people I ever worked with in science public policy. And yet he's personally attacked in the report that done by the Union of Concerned Scientists.
Bob Walker, Kurt Gottfried, I think we should get some of these details out here because not all of our listeners will know what's being referred to. I mean, I'm just looking at some of what's been posited and rebutted here. There was, of course, the White House demanding these significant revisions on climate change in the EPA's draft report on the environment, leading to that climate change section being taken out of the report. And as I understand, the rebuttal was and Kurt Gottfried's already said there was said to be another place for that. There were EPA proposed rules for regulating power plants' mercury emissions contained 12 paragraphs lifted, some verbatim, from a document prepared by industry attorneys in complaint over that. There was the White House, I don't know how to characterize this exactly, but pushing an abstinence-only agenda on the CDC. The White House posted a website for the National Cancer Institute suggesting a link between abortion and breast cancer, later revoked. Am I choosing the right examples out of your report, Kurt Gottfried?
No, they're a fine example. I'd be happy to talk about any of them.
Well, I mean, you gave him about 15 minutes before I even got on the air to talk about his position.
Well, you're here right now, Bob Walker. What do you have to say to these?
Okay, sure, absolutely. In the case of the EPA study, it was released as a part of an extensive strategic plan for the U.S. Climate Change Science Program. The EPA participated in that whole process. And exactly the material that they claimed was not released was, in fact, released as a part of a document that came out which had a broader reach and so on. In my view, the administration responded very well to that. And the fact is that that was reviewed by the National Academy of Sciences and received a highly favorable review from the National Academies in February of 2004.
All right, let's pick that one up.
Process, incorporating comments and advice from literally hundreds of scientists in both the U.S. and internationally.
All right, we hear the defense. Kurt Gottfried, what do you say?
Well, it's the New York Times first reported the dropping of this chapter by the on climate change by the EPA. This is a report that's not a research report. This is a report prepared for the body politic, the American public, on the environmental situation across the board and its implications for the future of the citizens of this country. A report was leaked from the EPA, which we have, and which also informed the New York Times report on this, which reflected a big struggle between the EPA technical staff and the White House, and finally the EPA decided to drop that chapter.
Well, can I rebut that,
Bob Walker?
Well, I haven't finished.
So now what we're doing is, I've just reported that the National Academies of Science in 2004 gave a highly favorable review to the Climate Change Science Program Strategic Plan, in which all of this material was included. And the rebuttal to that is that the New York Times published an article.
I don't think we got to that yet, Bob.
Hundreds of scientists who participated in that review may have more scientific merit than an article in the New York Times.
I think we just didn't get to that. Kurt Gottfried, what about this particular point?
Well, it's true that, of course, there was a climate research plan which has all the characteristics that Mr. Walker talked about. That's correct. That plan was not designed for public education. That's a big, complicated research plan which has a different purpose than the EPA plan. The point here was that the administration did not want a widely seen public document talking about climate change in an objective manner, but in the scientific, in the research plan, which the NAS, the National Academy of Science, reviewed, they, of course, were talking to a very different audience. And yes, that plan, that description is perfectly fine. From a public education point of view and a public reporting point of view, I think there was a serious distortion.
Bob Walker, why not let it be there?
So now we're talking about whether or not it's a good press release as compared to whether or not it's a thorough analysis of the relevant science.
Well, public education is part of government's role.
The relevant science is the important thing, not whether or not it's a good press release.
Well, that's perspective on it, though public education has a role as well. A lot of callers want to join us. I want to invite them in. Gordon is calling from Randolph, Massachusetts. Hi, Gordon. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
I was a subcontractor who worked on the draft report on the environment, and I just want to give our perspective, speaking for myself, not for my company, on what happened with the climate change chapter, because originally there was a climate change chapter, and it was dropped. And this report, as the speakers have been saying, was intended to be the State of the Environment report for where all the important environmental indicators are and where they're going. It was supposed to be the analogy for the economic indicators, where we see, you know, current indicators and leading indicators for the future. That was the whole purpose of it. So to say that the climate change indicators, the climate change section, was removed implies that the purpose of it is to say we don't want to know the information that is going to happen in those indicators. In other words, this was supposed to be the report that said these are all the important indicators that there are. And these are the things that we need to collect in order to find out what the state of the environment is for the future. By omitting the climate change indicators, it meant we're not going to collect data on that subject, ever. And since this is the primary report to decide what data will be collected, it implies that the Bush administration didn't want to know the answers on climate change at all.
Bob Walker?
Well, that's his interpretation of it, but the fact is that what the administration did was came up with a strategic plan to address a lot of these concerns across a wide swath of the science and environmental community. In my view, that's a more relevant science data than to come up with the numbers, which in fact relate back to the Clinton administration's decision that they wanted to do this largely for political effect. And so what we're talking about here is a Bush administration plan to go with better science rather than better press releases.
Well, there is one of the points debated, and you get a feeling for the flavor of this and how the two sides in the debate are coming down. Bob Walker, former chairman of the House Science Committee. Stick with us. Kurt Gottfried, chairman of the Union of Concerned Scientists. We are talking tonight about charges of distortion of science by the Bush administration and a rebuttal of those charges. You can join the conversation. If 20 Nobel laureates say there's suppression and distortion and the Bush administration says there's not, who do you believe? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about charges of distortion of science by the Bush administration, charges of the manipulation, suppression, and misrepresentation of science. 20 Nobel laureates say there's big trouble. Bush defenders say, point by point, no, there is not. I'm joined tonight by Bob Walker, former chairman of the House Science Committee, longtime member of the House of Representatives from Pennsylvania's 16th District, now chairman of Wexler & Walker, a Washington lobbying firm, and from Ithaca, New York, by Kurt Gottfried, emeritus professor of physics at Cornell and chairman of the Union of Concerned Scientists. You can join us as well. What do you hear in this debate? Could ideology or business interest be a real threat to mighty American science? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Rebecca is calling from Medford, Massachusetts. Hi, Rebecca. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a comment that I'd like to put to both your guests and see what they think of this. I'm a scientist by training. I work in environmental policy now. And my observation is that I feel that there's a pervasive politicization of science kind of on all sides. You know, industry and environmentalists each you know, get their own scientists, their own experts to support their point of view, and we end up debating the uncertainties of the science instead of really having the policy debates where people come out and say, you know, I think we should put all our money towards protecting the environment. I think we shouldn't, you know, pay for protecting the environment, that kind of thing. And I feel like also government, for its part, sometimes couches what are truly policy judgments in supposedly, you know, as if they're supposedly objective scientific decisions.
Rebecca, that sounds pretty dangerous. If nobody's giving real science, everybody's giving politics. Is that what you mean? That real science gets lost from both sides?
I think this use of science and playing on the uncertainties in the science to support various positions creates the appearance that there's maybe more uncertainty in the science than there really is. I guess my observation is more, are sort of the policymakers and the policy advocates on all sides hiding behind science because they sort of lack the courage to come out and really articulate their true policy positions.
That is an interesting point. Kurt Gottfried, what do you make of that?
I'm not quite sure what to make of that. I mean, I think that there's no question that scientists do have policy, believe certain policies are wise and mm-hmm. others are not.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it should be pointed out that if you take the group that we're discussing, the 60 people who drafted and signed this statement, we do not have a financial interest in the issues that we're talking about, which is not true of often of people who oppose the policies that we might be advocating, like in the case of clean air or mercury pollution from power plants. Mm. I mean, there are really monetary issues involved, which I can understand, but so these people have a rather different interest in what we're talking about here. But I think that there is, to a reasonable extent, it depends on what we're talking about, there is often quite clear scientific understanding of issues. I mean, there's no general rule as to how big the uncertainties are. I would admit that the uncertainties in climate change are rather bigger than the uncertainties, say, in the design of nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that uncertainties are often the place where everybody can hide. I think that it's really the climate change issue is an especially complicated one where the uncertainties are considerable. And the problem is very complex, and I think what the caller said may be quite valid there, but there are many other science issues where that's not the case.
Bob Walker, let me put the same question to you, if I may. Do you see a risk here of political agendas being pushed into science to the point that science itself becomes muddy, unclear, less useful than it should be?
Well, science is by far a contentious process, and it should be. There always ought to be questions in science, and scientists to raise those questions in order to search for further answers, and that's a good and healthy thing.
But when it achieves some slivers of clarity, you don't want deliberate obfuscation from any side.
Well, but the fact is, I think what your caller suggested was that policymakers ought to be very clear what their policies are and the direction that they go, that they want to go, so that people have a chance to make those decisions. And I agree with that thoroughly. I think policymakers have their role to play, and so do politicians in terms of defining their agendas. And scientists, like everybody else, can either decide whether their agendas are the right ones or the wrong ones, and then can participate vigorously in the political process and in the policymaking process with the knowledge that they bring to the table. What I do have a problem with at times is that in many cases, the people who sign on to these so-called reports are not people with any expertise in the field whatsoever. Most of the people who signed on to a lot of the material that was put out on climate change were not climatologists. There were a lot of public documents that were signed on by people who were social scientists, like I am, or lots of other scientific specialties that have absolutely nothing to do with climate. And it is that kind of distortion, I think, which is troublesome inside the overall scientific process. It's to be expected inside the political process. That's what happens in politics.
And Bob Walker, let me ask you, you're surfacing what you see as some potential biases in critics. You know, of course, that there's a perception, perhaps from another angle here, that the Bush administration brings some fundamentalist religious views to the White House that may be at odds with science, may bring the interests, some industrial interests to the table that may not be interested in seeing science that opposes their economic interests on the table. What about those concerns? What do you say to them?
The fact is that this administration has gone overboard to see to it that the kinds of policies that they stand up that demand scientific evaluation are in fact put before independent judgment, largely through the National Academies of Science, to find out whether or not they have bias problems in them. And in the case of a program that I'm very much involved with because of my work in the Congress, the hydrogen program that the president stood up, they in fact got back a critical report. But they didn't take umbrage at that. What they did was said, okay, there are some good suggestions in this report. Let's incorporate those in our program going forward. They've done this in a wide variety of cases. So sure, this administration has political constituencies. They have people who are friendly to them for a variety of reasons, but they are making certain that as they do their political stands, that those don't interfere with their scientific judgment. They allow scientists to review the policies to make certain that those policies are headed in the right direction.
Kurt Gottfried, this is an administration that has bent over backwards, Bob Walker says, to address bias.
Well, I simply have to disagree with that. I mean, if what Mr. Walker is saying, then, then not only we, but Science, the magazine Science with its editorials, Nature, to just give the two most prominent examples, are just misrepresenting the facts as they are. I didn't interrupt you.
Well, you've gotten more time to speak than I have.
I'd just like to hear the end of that point.
Is that true? Have I gotten more time?
I don't know, but Kurt Gottfried, please just give us the fill that point out if you'd be good enough.
I guess I lost my train of thought because I was interrupted like that. But
you're saying Nature and science.
No. Look, I mean, take the case of stem cell research. Now, we did not, in our statement purposely, we thought about it, we did not take up the case of stem cell research because we thought that the president was quite entirely correct to bring ethicists into this difficult issue.
Mm-hmm.
And that this is a complicated, really difficult issue with an important ethical, philosophical dimension. But when that committee drops the most outstanding stem cell scientists from its council, the president's council on bioethics, then that's exactly the kind of thing we're concerned about. There's no reason why they can't come out with they can come out with reports where there's a minority view, which might include that very prominent individual.
But have the minority there, Bob Walker. We're almost out of time. I want to give the last word to you tonight.
Well, thanks.
Sure.
As I say, there's been a little bit of attempt here to allow one side to.
Well, we wanted to get the charges, and we're looking for your rebuttal, and we're happy for any last word you'd like to share.
My point is that once again, when the rebuttal comes, it comes by quoting press sources rather than quoting scientific sources. I've tried to be very careful tonight to point out that this administration relies upon scientific advice. It doesn't rely upon whether or not the New York Times said something or Nature magazine said something or Science magazine said something. It says that scientists are the ones who should make the judgment. And so therefore, I think this administration, with the kind of emphasis that's put on science, as well as the kind of things that it has done to support science in the evaluation process,
should get credit for that.
And
with that, we're out of time. Bob Walker, thanks very much for joining us tonight. Kurt Gottfried, chairman of the Union of Concerned Scientists. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. Job cuts, escalating health care costs, sky high college tuition, Americans young and old are feeling the squeeze of belt tightening, and many state-sponsored programs once taken for granted are being axed. One such program was a tuition waiver for senior citizens registered at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Until recently, Marilyn Bentoff was a student at the university. She studied poetry and relished the opportunity to engage with students of all ages on campus. When the university dropped its tuition waiver for seniors, she could no longer attend the course. In this radio diary, Marilyn Bentoff wonders what happened to the money.
This January brought an end to Lloyd Schwartz's poetry workshop at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, for my friend Susie and me. Radical cuts in the state budget forced UMass to end its long-standing tuition waiver for seniors. It now costs $813 to attend a course. For me, poetry is a passion, and passion's important at my age. Despite my failing vision and unsteady legs, I braved public transportation to get to the workshop. My reward was delicious hours of poetry making and students young enough to be grandchildren who welcomed me with hugs. Now that's over. I still write at home, but I miss my UMass community, students and faculty who valued my participation. I miss the cafe, the mix of young faces with pierced noses and ears sitting together with wrinkled retirees. Now, I would be the first to agree that given funding cuts, subsidizing young students is a far greater priority than offering free classes to seniors. But it begs the question, why are elders and the young being pitted against each other in the richest country on earth? What happened to the money? Why are state governments choking for lack of money for basics like teachers and textbooks, kindergartens and hot lunches, music and physical education? This is America? A few decades ago, things were very different. I worked in North Carolina at Duke University in a program whose long-term objective, established in federal policy, was to support county initiatives that improved the lives of older people. I visited communities across the state. In four Blue Ridge counties, seniors were bused 5 days a week to a community center. It was there I met Mr. Rhodes, a retired farmer and widower. Mr. Rhodes lived in a two-room farmhouse. Every morning, Mr. Rhodes put on his hat and walked half a mile to the roadside to get the bus. For 2 hours, the bus drove from county to county, collecting seniors. They arrived at noon, had lunch, and spent the afternoon doing ceramics, sewing, carpentry, writing, even clogging, accompanied by a small band of mountain musicians. Fast forward 3 decades. Federal money to support quality of life at any age is now a luxury. Last November, I literally wept for joy when the faculty chose a poem of mine to represent UMass in a national competition. Now what? Should I laugh? As for my friend Susie, a few lines from her poem say it all. When you are arm-biting lonely, remember the coyote will gnaw through its own leg. Leave it in the trap, run on three to rejoin the tribe. Susie's arm-biting and wants to rejoin the tribe. So do I.
Marilyn Bentoff lives in Newton, Massachusetts. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.